Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This podcast is brought to you by GoToMyPC, easiest way to access your PC from anywhere via the web. Check it out at gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast. Well, hello and a great July to you. This is Andrew Horowitz coming to you live, kind of, sort of, podcast style from beautiful downtown Fort Lauderdale area in Florida. And it is hot as can be. So are the markets. I must tell you that over the last week or so, we've seen quite a dramatic change. Question is it a bull market? Is it a bear market rally? We'll talk about that in a moment, some of the conditions that are setting up. But more importantly, I was kind of interested in talking about a couple different stocks, some of the technology numbers that came out, and then we're going to get into a conversation with Matt Taibbi, who is, he wrote the Rolling Stones article that pretty much obliterated, if you remember that whole Goldman Sachs discussion, how Goldman Sachs is a blood-sucking squid wrapped around the face of humanity. Paraphrasing Matt. Anyway, he wrote it. We were able to grab an interview with him. He's been very popular of late. There's been a lot of discussion back and forth. John Stewart, as a matter of fact, this Sunday you'll see on the DisciplinedInvestor.com blog, we put a John Stewart video on there where he was talking about Goldman Sachs. There's been a lot of discussion, not only in the media, but it seems that it's starting to catch on around the government as well. What's going on exactly here? We saw an amazing number. I mean, a blowout number. And again, we're going to talk about that in a second because I want to talk about what happened with Meredith Whitney on Monday when it came to her appearance on CNBC. I'm going to rant a little bit about CNBC in this episode as well and give you a couple different ideas that you need to know about. So let's start off with the discussion about, let's go way back, let's do this chronologically, okay? Let's talk about 2 weeks ago when we saw that there was a clear and present danger in the markets, that we were seeing a topping off in the 950 range on the S&P 500. A lot of stocks were starting to get very, very weak, particularly in the materials sector. And overall, it really looked like a very difficult time for the markets, if you recall. And we talked about that, not only here, but on DH Unplugged as well. And I became very concerned. We started to increase our short positions on our portfolio as hedges and pull back a little bit on the broad-based long positions that we had and holding on to the core positions that we like. And that was great for 2 weeks. You know, things were very good. And if you notice what happened, the market sold off pretty rough. I mean, but what was interesting about that was that there was a very, very, a line in the sand. It was 875 on the S&P 500. It kept on bouncing off of that. And if you recall, about 2 months ago, I had talked about this theory I had. And I said that one of the things that's going to happen is that the market probably is going to go down over time. Maybe not today, tomorrow, but over time. And what's going to happen is going to be these points. 875 is one, 810 is another, about 760 or 775 could be another. 750 clearly is another. And these are points on the S&P, we call them bounce points, that could either be one of two things. I'm going to give you, on one side and on the other. On one side, it could be a point where money managers who were not in the market at all, missed the entire upside or were short, turned around and said, you know what, we're changing our position at this point. And all of a sudden, they go from being, let's just use that as an example, out of the market, and they say, you know what, we're not going to miss this again. So they put their money in, and all of a sudden, it just pushes the market up dramatically. We saw that almost three times on Q, a little bit greater than I would have anticipated, to be honest with you, but three times in the last week and a half when all of a sudden the market looked like it was going to break down and hit as low as 869 on the S&P 500, and it dragged down not only every stock, but it dragged down gold and oil, everything across the board and internationally was just dragged down by this. And it's interesting that we have this herd mentality going along where when the markets are up, gold is up, oil is up, Asia's up, Europe is up. When the markets are down here, I'm talking about U.S. often, we're seeing the same thing happen globally. And you can reverse that discussion and say, well, when the markets are up in Asia, we're up over here, and they're up in Europe, and vice versa. That is not a really great scenario because if we see a tremendous break in one particular market due to an unforeseen circumstances, like maybe the CIT issue that's coming aboard, which is a major bankruptcy that looks like it's pending to happen very near. The government said they do not want to bail out CIT, if you've been following that. We're talking about $8 billion in order to keep them afloat. They have a degrading portfolio of loans. Primarily, they deal with small businesses giving out loans in the million to $2 million for all sorts of things like office leases of maybe, well, it could be furniture, it could be equipment, it could be for short-term bridge financing. There's a whole bunch of things that they do. But basically, they're finding that they can't keep up. The government already infused about $2.5 billion into them and says, you know what, we're not doing anymore. We find that the portfolio they have, according to Sheila Bair, who is the head of the FDIC, it's just not going to be worth their while to save, which is really interesting. Question is, who's going to get that? Who's going to get that portfolio? Because if it collapses like Washington Mutual did, well, J.P. Morgan and a few other guys, when it came to the various banks, got a piece of that, right? I mean, the different banks went to J.P., Merrill went to Bank of America, of course, and we've seen these, I don't want to even call them acquisitions, we'll call them kind of assumptions. And if, in fact, CIT goes under, who is going to be, you know, the player that's going to get it? Could it be GE? I was talking to my friend over at Zero Hedge the other day, Tyler, and he said that possibly GE is going to be the biggest player for that and the biggest beneficiary. We saw their earnings came out and they were abysmal. And even though they look good on the surface, which is a really interesting thing, I'm going to just hold this thought, but I just remind me, CNBC and news items and top line / flash item. Okay, we'll get to that in a second. I'm counting on you now to remind me, okay? All right, so now what we have is the situation with CIT that may be GE, but again, I don't know how they're going to do it if they're trying to clean up their loan portfolio. Even though they'll get some benefit from it, they still have a lot of problems and they have to work through those assets. But nonetheless, so we have the markets doing what they do. Meredith Whitney comes on CNBC on Monday morning, last Monday, and talks about how Goldman's going to blow out numbers. Okay, they're coming out on Tuesday morning with numbers. And initially, we saw a dramatic change to the S&P futures pre-market, and they were looking okay. Everything was looking good. A couple other earnings were coming out, and that was good. But what's interesting about Meredith Whitney, who was the one who called the Citibank, the initial real break on Citibank, Citigroup, where they were going to suspend their dividend, they're going to have a lot of problems, and it plummeted. I mean, just absolutely plummeted last year in September or so. And she gets credit for that, and she's a star, and she starts her own firm, and everything's great. But she comes on a Monday morning prior to Goldman. I mean, why wasn't she on 2 weeks before? I was talking to a few other people. They think, wait a minute, you know, Goldman knew their numbers and all that. And what happened? Why did she come out so late the day before? And why was it? It was a cheerleading session is what it was. Let's be very honest about this, okay? Because what's happening is that the information on CNBC is being twisted a little bit. And I'm going to share that with you in a second, a couple of things that I've noticed. And I don't mean to be, you know, negative on this and all, and you know, rah, rah, soos, boom, bah, I'm with you on this. I want to be positive. I want the economy to get better and all that. Great. And I have some things, and there's some things that I see that are better, clearly. Some things I see that are worse. Depends on how you want to look at it. But generally speaking, you know, things are definitely starting to bottom out here. They could turn a little bit down further in terms of manufacturing and inventory build and unemployment. But, you know, generally we're seeing some stabilization. Let's be honest about that. Some general stabilization, if not you know, stopping of the downward trend. But that's not good enough. That isn't good enough. We need an economy that's growing, obviously. But, you know, stabilization right now, if that's all we can get, I'm okay with it. But the point is that when we look at what Whitney did, I was really interested in how the market right after that, when the market opened, it went down again on Monday. And it went down towards the 875. I keep saying 775. I don't know. It must be in my head. But it goes down to the 875 level. And at the 875 level, what happens is it bounces again. Not only does it bounce, 10:30 in the morning, it takes a ride up like you've never seen. It goes from down 1% to up 2.5% that day. And what we're hearing is on the kind of the flash is, well, it's because Meredith Whitney upgraded and said that Goldman's going to have a blowout. Now, if that was the case, wouldn't we have seen that reaction throughout the day? I mean, wouldn't we have seen, early in the day, I mean, wouldn't we have seen that the follow-through from the buy recommendation at 8 o'clock in the morning would have followed through to the opening at 9:30? But what happened between 9:30 and 10:30 that we saw this dramatic sell-off, which was the continuation from the week before? Well, we saw the bounce at 8:75. Interesting. But not only do we see a bounce, we saw a dramatic bounce. Why? Because shorts were getting squeezed out as it was starting to move up, and this was a kind of a play that was going on. It's been going on a few times. It didn't break. It held at 875. Technical analysis is something important to look at. It was a little overdone, in my opinion. Everybody knew the numbers coming out of Goldman that it was going to be on trading, that it used what was called VAR, V-A-R, value at risk, an unaudited measure of how much of their capital that they have at risk at any given time that they could lose in, let's say, one given day. $240 million is a number that they have. It has been said that Goldman has used a lot of the money from TARP to put into the market, and basically, think about it. They put the money, $10, $5, $6 billion in the market in March. What did they care? What did they care? If they lost that money, what would happen? Think about it. They'd get more. Okay, so fine. Goldman saved the day. Goldman ruined the day. However you want to look at it. But what's interesting is that one person's commentary is being said and claimed that it is the reason why the markets went up so dramatically. Goldman did, of course, beat. J.P. Morgan did, of course, beat. But let's also not to forget some important conditions. Any analyst that's worth their weight in salt will tell you that they had a lot of things over the last several quarters that allowed them to beat. Number one, Goldman clearly beat it on trading, but you know, we could put that aside for a second. What are the banks doing? The banks are beating because they have that change with the mark-to-market, FASB 157, I believe it's 157. And they also have the ability to basically borrow money at zero and lend it out. On top of that, there's a few other accounting issues that they need to, that they're able to do to make things look much better than they are. They still have, and we have seen warnings from JP and other places that they're still having loan delinquencies and loan and foreclosures and loan and bankruptcies and loan being written off at record levels. So the question is, are we out of the woods yet? Is this just a technical bounce? Where do we go? I will tell you that there is clearly money that wants this market to go up. No question about that. Or said better way, there's clearly money that doesn't want this market to go down. The question is going to be, once we get past the week of the bank who seemed to be blowing it out, you know, Bank of America came in, JP Morgan came in, Goldman came in, GE came in, it wasn't so pretty, but they all came in and they actually gave good numbers according to the top line numbers, you know, what you just look at. When you have to dig down though, you have to get a little deeper into this information to figure out what's really going on. On the opposite side of the coin is a company that we actually started buying recently, Cintas, C-T-A-S. Now, why do we start buying that for the portfolios? Now, I wrote about this recently, and I said, you know, yeah, it's a uniform company. Sounds a little bit ridiculous to buy a uniform company when unemployment is so high as it is, right? You know, they supply janitorial, they supply uniforms, they supply all sorts of different types of services that are involved in basically business. I mean, that's what it is. It's business. But what's interesting about that, when I looked at it, was that this company, we bought a little bit prior to the earnings announcement. We bought a little bit after the earnings announcement. And what we found was that overall, the company was pretty much at their bottom point here. I mean, how much worse can it get for a company that's at the height of the problems? It's kind of like, if you think about it, the banks in a way, when they were in the height of their problems. And then they turn around a little bit because, you know, they get so crazed with sellers that it's kind of, they get exhausted. Now, what I found was this, that on this company, Cintas, and I put this on the Disciplined Investor website, and I'll put a link to this also. This is a company that has worked on restructuring the distribution and inventory management. We've seen this before in other firms, right? Earnings had held up generally well, but what was really interesting was when the top line information came out and kind of splashed across the screen, it was said that their numbers dropped dramatically to like a 3 cent number when they were expecting about 37 cents or so. Analysts were expecting about 37 cents, and they came in at, I think it was three. But they took a $58 million restructuring charge to actually clean up a few things, inventory changes, et cetera. Their real number, when you exclude items and you use continue operations, was a total of 38 cents. And their revenues came in just slightly under, and they actually beat on the revenues. Stock got hit a little bit. But, you know, when we look at that, we look at the stock a little bit better. What I like about it is that their estimated EPS next year is still at almost $2, $1.96. Their PE next year is only 11. PEG ratio is a little bit high for me right now at about 1.4. So are the return on common equity is a little bit light, about 10. I like about 15. Price to earnings ratio, again, today is about 12. But I like the beta, which is the risk factor, is about a 1. That's good. And overall, I think it's, you know, a stock that I was liking. Here's a points that I wanted to consider. Total assets are actually growing in this company as it's doing well to pretty much conserve cash. Long-term liabilities are shrinking. Current liabilities are also shrinking. So in other words, they'll have less debt service. Earnings had dropped from 0.03 cents a share from 47 cents the previous quarter, but you need to add back that one-time charge and you're at 37. Operating margins are at 13, estimated to be 14. They were at 14 to 15 about 5 years ago, but they have 34,000 employees, a lot of them doing deliveries, cleaning, the work, et cetera. But, you know, generally speaking, yes, their gross margin is about now still about holding at about 41. On the last, it was as high as maybe 42 in May of 07. Its pre-tax margin is what really kind of got hurt a little bit, down to about 9.5 from about 14 about 2 years ago. But you have to expect that in this kind of environment where they're obviously cutting costs at the same time cutting prices to make sure that people can pay. Their sales growth is a little bit down, but their net income growth is really where the problem came in, because obviously a lot less people are going into the working in business. But here's what I think is interesting. If you think there's a recovery coming, at least in the near term, maybe in the little bit of longer term, and there's going to be any kind of lessening of jobs losses, I don't care if they go down to 300, 400, you know, or stabilize where we are here and get, you know, at this point, this is kind of, I think, the bottom point for this company. So take a look at it. Cintas, I thought I'd bring that to you, something that we've been looking at, kind of a, not a name that's out in the front. The other thing that I want to mention to you is, wow, what in the world is going on with technology? You know, we wrote a piece that we write every single quarter for our clients. This, by the way, is the last quarter that we're going to provide that free of charge to everybody. So if you haven't gotten yours right now, we'll put a link on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, in the show notes for this. And what people always ask me, how do you get to the show notes? The show notes are simple. You just go at the top. It says what the podcast, number 118, which is this podcast. Click it, and there's all the show notes. Everything about what we talked about on the show, the author, the information about the summary of the show, the bio of the guest, information about what you have to look at, the stocks that we mentioned, etc. So we'll put in the show notes that link so you can grab yourself a copy. And anybody that wants to talk to me about their portfolios next week, we'll make it a couple of days available next week. We're kind of having an open phone with Andrew. So if you want to do that, click on the link. Laura will set you up to get you a copy of a third quarter economic review and commentary where we talk about such things as, listen to this. We call it, when you think of what's going on with technology, let me kind of bring you into this. When you think about what's going on with technology, technology has taken the place of humans, machines, robotics, and technology, and that's why we're seeing such high unemployment level. At the same time, we're seeing earnings per share do a lot better, right? We're seeing revenue down on a lot of companies, EPS higher. Why? I told you that we're cutting the labor costs. So when we look at that, what happens? Well, machines don't eat, they don't consume, they don't do anything. They don't buy shirts, they don't, you know. So machines are not going to help in the recovery process. They will help with the EPS short term. So I think we have what's called a consumption cannibalism going on right now. Technology is wonderful. We just saw IBM blow out numbers. Google did better, but you know what? The sequential overall ad revenue, and this was no mystery to anybody, let's be honest. There's no way their sequential growth is going to be the same as we saw a couple of years ago. I think we added 3%. Now, that's great in this time, but not so great when you consider what Google is and the PE and the multiple they're really trading on. And not to mention the fact that however lame Microsoft's Bing is and Yahoo and all, they're starting to hit again, and the ad center for Microsoft is starting to hit Google again. They're starting to really attack that. Even though Google's coming out with an OS, I don't think it's going to be any kind of competition to speak of. But we also have a lot of things happening with Microsoft that's negative. But the technology shares have done very well. IBM did a lot of business overseas. Intel blew out. Why? Because of their Atom chip. They did that overseas, selling a tremendous amount of netbooks. AT&T, Verizon coming out netbooks. The Atom's going to be selling. Problem is, the over time, the Atom will also become another commodity, and Intel will kind of lose its luster there. So that up, we're not real big fans of the semiconductors, and we're not big fans of Intel. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, technology has done just remarkable. While it trailed off dramatically over the last few weeks, I mean, we have seen Apple reaching new highs again, which is mind-boggling to me. Although we saw Nokia getting blown out because they're just not having any sales compared to Research in Motion and Apple. So while we're seeing some just amazing numbers out of the technology area, industrials, materials are still questionable. Healthcare is the big wild card right now. What's going to happen with Obama? So, I mean, there's lots to consider in this market right now, and there's a lot of moving parts that can really throw things on its side. And don't forget something. Technology is going to have a kind of, it's going to have a crescendo, right? I mean, maybe not entirely just tomorrow, but it will have a crescendo, just like unemployment. You know, we don't need any more people working, and we're going to have that much more technology. After a while, we're going to have so much technology, you're not going to need any more technology. There's just so much efficiency you'll be able to grab out of things. in the near term, of course, until something changes dramatically in the future. Okay? So, let's talk about CNBC for a second. CNBC has been doing a lot of cheerleading lately. And you know I'm not a big fan of Dennis Neely, and we got to get him. He's been picking on the bloggers out there because a lot of bloggers don't use their real names. They use pseudonyms, and they kind of hide behind this anonymity issue. And that's interesting. It's okay. I'm not exactly sure what that's about. Probably some of it's about that some of the information that they grab is some information that most people can't get from the hedge fund world out there, from the traders, from the market makers, etc. And they don't want to give it to people with a name because then they can be identified. But they can't be identified when it comes to these anonymous bloggers. Okay, that's interesting. But he's been attacking these guys, Dennis Neely. And I got to tell you something, Dennis Neely, with his dancing and his moving and his ridiculous nature of his bullish attitude in the face of information that is to the contrary, is quite frustrating. The other thing that's very disturbing to me is the continuation of the top line, front line flash numbers. You know, CNBC keeps on flashing information. They said that Nouriel Roubini has changed. Basically, they said something to the effect of Nouriel Roubini is saying that the recession will end in 2009. And growth in the future. Roubini immediately, this is Thursday, came out with a statement that said, this is not true, this was misinterpreted, misrepresented, and I want to clear the air. And he put that out. And we read that very clearly and said that, you know, Roubini has not changed any of his assumptions. He believes it's possible to be a U-shape or possibly a W-shape recovery for the U.S. and believes that while the recession may end in 2009, growth will be pretty much anemic. But that's one thing, and that drove the markets up on Thursday. The other thing that's interesting is that they're doing a little thing that I think is very cute. You know, when you read a chart, a graph, you read from left to right, don't you? Think about it for a second. Left to right, bar chart, left to right. You know, when the number goes chronologically usually, or, you know, you see one, two, three, and it goes left to right. Left being the oldest, right being the newest. Well, what's happening now, very cute, I've never seen this before. CNBC is doing the exact opposite. So they're showing you previous earnings results on the usually what they're doing is showing current earnings results, on the left, previous on the right. So it almost looks like there's growth. If you just look up at the screen and you don't pay attention to what you're looking at, what you see is EPS on the left is much lower and on the right is much higher, and you, or even revenue numbers, the same thing. And they're doing this for two different sessions, and they're showing that what it is it looks like they have good growth, but it's actually reverse. I have never seen this before, and I wish somebody would tell me, did they do this a few years ago, or they recently switched this around? Because something's very wrong with this whole nature of when they try to look at numbers, for example, at GE today, and they're trying to pull out all the good numbers, all the good information, the same thing with Bank of America, all the information that's good, all the information, only the good stuff. That's good, right? That's good. And you hear it all the time on the morning show. That's good information, isn't it? Oh, they're loaning. That's good. Oh, that's what you were looking for. Oh, that's great. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. You don't hear about any of the real negative things. You don't really go into a lot of the kind of negative sentiment. They make fun of things like the head and shoulders pattern, which maybe is to be made fun of, but it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, why are you making fun of this? Just aren't you there as a news organization to present the facts? I told you what happened with Bloomberg a few weeks ago when they put out some information from the Federal Reserve, the Beige Book, and they were clearly being in the headline and also in the first paragraph or so saying that, you know, there was a good number of the Federal Reserves that said there was stabilization and possible some growth in their sectors, et cetera, et cetera. But you got down to the other side and they showed that the majority of Federal Reserves said that there was continued contraction in their regions. Now, I'll tell you something. Continued contraction by majority. Couldn't that have been said that way in the title? Why not? Well, I wrote to the journalist. And I said, what's the story here? Well, we're trying to put a good light on the economy and say that it's bottomed and it's getting better, et cetera, et cetera. And if you want to see the other article, it's right here. Here's a link. I said, other article? What other article? Well, the other article was buried. It was buried. You couldn't find it if you tried. That was the negative article that showed the facts. The other article was the frontline headline article, the one that you found right on the front of Bloomberg. I mean, you know what? Give him a big Bronx cheer for that one. And CNBC, big Bronx cheer, okay? You know what? Cheerleading is great. We want to feel better. I think it's awesome. Give me the facts. We can make our own decisions. We're smart enough. You afraid we're not smart enough? I mean, I think it's pretty simple. Well, let's get to our discussion with Matt Taibbi. Before we do that, I got 5 emails this week. People asked me something that happened last summer, and they said, Andrew, how do we find your money management? What do you do? And I'm thinking, I thought I said that, but I don't know. Maybe I'm not saying it enough. I don't know. You know what? If you want to check out a virtual tour of how we manage money and what we do and kind of some of the things that go on at Horowitz & Company, and especially with the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, I think we just ended up July and we are June. We got the June numbers in, and I think we beat the S&P by something like 28% over the last 1 year. We have some ups and downs, et cetera. You know, things don't always go right for us, but we are keeping our head above water very nicely and very limited. Losses is the name of the game. That doesn't mean they won't happen, of course, but, you know, over a monthly, quarterly, annual period. And the S&P was down, I think, 32% or something like that over the same period. And we're pretty proud of the performance we had. So if you want to check out more than a mutual fund, you want to know about how we're managing money, it's $50,000 minimum. There's a virtual tour you can check out. Very easy to check out. Go over to the Disciplined Investor. This podcast will put a link, very bold, take the virtual tour and go hear me talk about, it's about 14 minutes, me talking about audio and visual, about, you know, how we manage money, some of the things in the past. We have a couple updates we have to do to that and kind of change a few things. And then we'll have some links to some of the performance we had over the recent months, okay? When we get back, we'll be talking with Matt Taibbi. He's the Rolling Stones author who pretty much smashed going pretty well. Pretty well. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Stick around for more of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
And we have a special guest today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, someone who has written just an amazing article called The Great American Bubble Machine. It's a story about some people on the one side getting very rich at the expense of the rest of us, frankly. And talking about Goldman Sachs in particular, really zeroing in. You probably saw him and read this. And if you haven't, we put the links to Rolling Stone, who actually put this out. It's Matt Taibbi. And welcome today, my friend.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
So, you know, I think I went through some of the videos and saw how where this started and the genesis of this. And it kind of, you know, it wasn't, I don't think you start out looking for a smear campaign or anything like that. But what was it that got under your skin? And just give us some real basis of, you know, what you think, you know, how it started that you kind of all of a sudden get your ears perked up to the whole Goldman Sachs situation.
Well, obviously, I don't have any background as a financial reporter at all. So, you know, what happened was that when I had to do a story earlier this year on the causes of the financial crisis, and we focused a lot on the AIG bailout for that story, and in the process of interviewing people about that whole episode, I started to notice this theme, which was that anytime anybody in the financial community mentioned Goldman Sachs, I usually have to, like, endure a 5 or 10 minute rant about how, you know, how evil these guys were before we could get back to the subject I was actually interested in. And so, you know, I thought it would be worthwhile after looking in a little bit at the history of this company to use Goldman Sachs as a way to tell the story of how Wall Street has been behaving in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years because they were kind of at the scene of the crime whenever there was some kind of like enormous scam or a, you know, a financial disaster happening. It would be easy to use this company as a way to explain things to people who maybe don't have a background in this stuff.
So one of the things that you mentioned here is that I think you start out with one of my favorite lines is the world's most powerful investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. So is that what, so? Are you telling me that you're using Goldman Sachs as a metaphor for the big financial machines, or are you talking about Goldman Sachs here?
Both, you know, I think we made that point in the piece that you know, Goldman is both a metaphor for a larger problem, you know, that mm-hmm. and they represent you know, their experience is common to the experience of a lot of other investment banks, and you know, you could learn a lot from about everything on Wall Street by just by looking at Goldman. However, they are also separate and apart from everybody else, kind of a unique phenomenon in Wall Street because they're so powerfully interconnected with the government that they kind of almost stand apart from the rest of Wall Street as in sort of a gray area between public and private in a way that the other banks do not. So I guess the answer to that is they, you know, I'm specifically talking about Goldman and I'm using mm-hmm. them as a metaphor to talk about
what's interesting, I think, is that during the height of the crisis this year, we know that Henry Paulson, who was the former Treasury Secretary, basically got down on a knee and begged Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, not to let this thing go down, as I think was some of the comments. And basically, it was a weird moment in time when he was begging for the $750 billion bailout. At that time, what I also found interesting was that Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, they had to step down as investment banks and become bank holding companies. You remember that?
Right, absolutely.
I could swear at the time that one of the requirements was that they would have to give up their prop trading. Do you recall that also?
I don't remember that. No, is that the case?
I've been looking back and trying to find where that was, but I remember saying, wow, I couldn't believe they're going to have to give up their prop trading because now they're a bank holding company, and bank holding companies won't be able to do that. And
But they haven't given it up.
They've charged it up, haven't they? They haven't. Right, not only have not given it up, they've kind of taken it to the next level. Which is really interesting, which I guess I got to go back and look at that again. But, you know, one of the things that you talk about is, you know, you take this all the way back to the Great Depression and all the various different circumstances that happened where they were basically reselling and reselling and reselling companies over and over back to the technology boom where basically we're selling these companies and, you know, puffing them up with all sorts of hot air. And then all the way through the recent housing bubble where they were packaging up crap mortgages and putting them into securitized deals, at the same time selling them off and then basically writing puts on them, realizing that it was crap they put in there and they were going to frown. So, I mean, is there anything that can be done about this? Because right now, it's happening again. I don't know if you're aware of this. I believe it was Merrill and Morgan Stanley. Now, let me think about this for a second. I think it's Morgan Stanley. They're packaging up below-grade investments again. It was just in today's paper.
I just read that, and they're going to be selling them as AAA investments.
Have you heard the story before or what?
I just saw it like literally 5 minutes before we got on the phone together.
It's shocking.
Somebody sent me with the subject line. It's like 2003 all over again with the subject line.
It's unbelievable. it's unbelievable. But you know what? At the end of the day, let's be honest about something. If Goldman, or again, using that metaphorically, or Goldman, if Goldman or any of these guys, or anybody out there, it seems, any bank, does a really bad thing. In other words, they obliterate money, and it seems that what's the difference anyway? They're going to be backed up by the government.
Right. Yeah, and that's one of the things that a lot of people were complaining about. I mean, I talked to Simon Johnson, you know, the professor at MIT who wrote a pretty famous article on Atlantic Monthly earlier this year about, you know, this kind of commingling of state and private. And you know, I asked him, is it an implicit advantage for Goldman Sachs on Wall Street that everybody knows that if they slip up, the government is going to bail them out? And he said, no, it's not an implicit advantage at all. He goes, it's an explicit advantage at this point. After what happened last year with AIG, you know, the message that everybody gets on Wall Street is that Goldman Sachs is not going to go down under any circumstances. It's just not going to happen. I mean, no matter what mistake they make, they're going to be bailed out, and that is an enormous market advantage, and we could see that most explicitly in what happened with when they did their share issuance earlier this year. I mean, they made an enormous amount of money at a time when the company was not doing all that well. They shouldn't have been able to borrow that much money that quickly, and they did because people have confidence that they're going to be able to pay back come hell or high water.
Right, depending no matter how it gets. I mean, and you made the point that the AIG bailout, the original $85 billion, a big chunk of that went right to Goldman.
It was really a bailout of Goldman Sachs. I mean, Lloyd Blankfein was in the room when that deal was concluded, which, you know, it tells you a lot about what was really going on there. I mean, AIG owed Goldman about $20 billion, and at least $13 or $14 billion of that got paid off immediately through the AIG bailout. And, you know, don't forget that Paulson also installed another former Goldman banker named Ed Liddy as head of AIG, going forward. So, you know, Goldman got paid off 100 cents in the dollar on its, on the money that AIG owed it, whereas if it had been a normal bankruptcy, if the state hadn't intervened, they might have gone out of business. And instead, they ended up rescued. And simultaneously, they had Henry Paulson decide not to rescue Lehman Brothers, their biggest competitor, at the same time. So what should have been a disaster turned into a gigantic windfall for Goldman.
And then I think the funniest story of all of it really is that when they were being regulated as a bank holding company out of the state of New York by the gentleman who's in charge of it, actually, he knew all the information that was going on. He bought Goldman shares at some ridiculously low amount.
Friedman.
And all that happened was he stepped down. And the funniest part of the story is that who now is in charge is another ex-Goldman.
Right, right. Is that Donaldson? What's his name?
It's unbelievable. Listen to me. You couldn't have written this. I don't care what kind of talent you have, my friend. You couldn't have written this unless it was real. Right or wrong?
Right. No, that was one of the funny things about it, is that after the article came out, I started to get all these letters saying, hey, you know, this is just a conspiracy theory. And I'm like, but it is a conspiracy. I mean, you know, what is the word conspiracy mean? It means to breathe together. And that's what, you know, this is a classic example of the state and a single company, you know, breathing together. They're doing business together. It's a kind of a circular process where Goldman is allowed to take advantage of all kinds of things, and they funnel money directly back to the same politicians who give them these favors. They were the number one private contributor to both Democratic congressional candidates last year and to the president, Barack Obama, last year. And they have an enormous amount of influence, and it just seems to be unending.
So now, recently, since your article came out, what was the date that you actually published that article? Do you remember?
I think the publishing date was July 9th, but that's today, right? So it was probably 2 weeks ago it came out.
Okay, so one of the things that's interesting is that since then, the quote-unquote proprietary code for Goldman for their trading has been seemingly
stolen, right?
And what I thought was the most interesting part of the commentary by the judge was that they said that in the wrong hands, this proprietary trading code could allow someone to manipulate markets.
But in the right hands, it's just Goldman Sachs doing legal business, right?
I suppose. I mean, I find that I was shocked. I said, what are you talking about? And then on top of it, they said, you know, this code, I don't know what this code could possibly do. I understand, you know, how it works, et cetera. But obviously, we need to know a little bit more about these kind of codes, because sitting on the other side of the screens, on the other side of the investments, you know, it makes me a little nervous. Like, what's going on around here? I mean, you know, we're talking about my money, my client's money. I mean, I'm not interested in just getting ransacked.
Right, right. I mean, and then, you know, the fact that, from what I understand, that they're gonna take extraordinary measures to make sure that a lot of that evidence is not made public in this case. So we're probably not going to find out what's actually in that code.
Well, it's interesting because the code was supposedly transferred to a German server, and who knows where it's going to end up right here.
Right.
And I think that, you know, if you could reverse engineer what they did. I mean, this has been discussion about the gentleman who stole the code was very involved in the phone companies and writing code for text messaging. And supposedly if the New York Stock Exchange and various places that get the orders routed through to them, if you can kind of nail that, sniff that out, if you will, prior to it being executed, you have just an interesting advantage there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know? And I think, isn't that the argument that Zero Hedge has been making for months now? That there's something fishy going on.
Something fishy.
What's also interesting is that after this guy, he's Russian, right? This guy is
correct.
Right. After he steals it, somehow the FBI gets mobilized like right away. You know, I mean, again, this is just another example of how wired into the government Goldman is. I mean, I don't think you or I would be able to just call the FBI up on the phone and make sure that, you know, whoever gets arrested almost immediately.
Right.
And that's another example of how far the reach in this company is.
So is there anything, I mean, after you've done all this and you've talked to a lot of people and all, is there anything that can, you know, is there something we really should be scared of here? I mean, besides all of it? you know, seriously, is it just Goldman? Is it the other guys too? Is it the government that's condoning it? I mean, I can't imagine the government condones all this going. I can't imagine it. I don't know.
Well, one of the things that's one of the big problems with all of this is that a lot of what these guys do for a living, and I'm sure you know this, you know, even Congress people don't understand it. So, you know, they're relying on their aides and they're relying on their friends to tell them what's good economic policy and what isn't. And because so many, you know, of the mainstream politicians in both parties, and both the Democrats and the Republicans, get their advice from either current or former, you know, members of these investment banks, they just basically trust this whole community to tell them what to do. I don't think there are very many people in government who truly independently understand this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the few who do tend to be beholden to these companies because they get so much campaign contributions from them. So there's only a handful of guys in government who both understand it and are actively opposing, you know, or acting as a counterweight to these companies, which is kind of scary because they have kind of limitless influence because of that.
Right. So you talk about also in the end of the article the next possible catastrophe that's coming, and this is the carbon credit issue. I think you talk about that. This cap and trade, where there's going to be a market that is going to allow for the ability for polluters, that people that are and non-polluters, the lumber yards and the forests, to have these carbon credits that could be exchanged. But one of the interesting things about that is that the exchange is basically set up that there'll be a diminishing amount of carbon credits available over time, therefore automatically making the price a lot higher.
Right. It means that means you have a naturally ascending commodity, you know, and everybody that I talk to, I mean, because you saw what happened with the other commodities market last summer. People think it's going to be basically a repeat of what happened with, you know, the oil commodities and oil futures last year, but it's going to be even worse because this time around, you know, you're going to have that sort of naturally rising price that's going to make everybody a lot of money. The thing is, they could have done this whole cap and trade deal, as a straight carbon tax that would have been set by the government and collected by the government. Instead, they created this convoluted system that is just going to allow all kinds of other extraneous players to make money off this deal. So while it might end up actually reducing the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and it might end up being good for the environment, it's going to also be a gigantic giveaway to, you know, the same investment banks.
Which is, again, I'm hard-pressed to understand why that's going to go through. I mean, there's going to be a fight about the cap and trade. There's a reasonable discussion why this is going to really cost the U.S. economy a lot of money. And while I have enormous respect for our president and all that, I mean, something's just got to give here. You can't do everything at once. You can't have, reform of the financial institutions, which is fine, and the health care initiative, which is fine, and a $12 trillion potential bailout, which is not fine, but it's what it is. And then on top, I mean, you just can't outspend, you know, and then own GM and be you can't do all this.
Right. But for some reason, they made it a legislative priority. I mean, the fact that they took this to markup this year before they even got to the healthcare issue tells you that it's a major priority of this administration, and that it's, you know, they have 60 votes now in the Senate. They're going to be able to push through more or less anything they want. So, it's unlikely that some version of this isn't going to go through. It just might take a little while.
Interesting. All right, so I guess in closing with that, I mean, is there anything else that after you wrote this article that you found out, some other things you dug up? I mean, what else is going on? What else do we need to be aware of? Or is it just kind of just, you know, game over here?
I've been reassigned to cover the healthcare thing since then, so I haven't been watching Goldman too much. But, I thought it was interesting that I'm sure you heard that the New York Stock Exchange decided to stop releasing data about its program trading a couple of weeks ago. Did you see that whole business?
Oh, I didn't see that. That's interesting. What timing of that? Wow, look at that.
It was just before the story about the theft broke. But it was pretty clearly, you know, something that they did for Goldman Sachs directly, you know, in order to answer Zero Hedge, I mean, which has been doing these analyses of New York Stock Exchange program trading for months and months and months. And now they've suddenly stopped releasing that data that Zero Hedge has been analyzing just, to, I guess, to avoid the annoyance, which just shows you, again, the reach of this company. You know, they can get the NYSE to do whatever they want just to stop having to be criticized, which is pretty an amazing thing.
Yeah, well, the other thing that they did, though, is that we saw that the CFTC is actually going to be, at least they say, looking into the whole oil trading thing a year later. But they're really getting serious about it. They've been on TV. They've been talking about it. I mean, we're getting the circulation that there is now a year later, there was manipulation of the oil markets and of the commodities markets. You know, all of a sudden, before it was all supply and demand, and we're sitting there going, what do you mean supply and demand? There's plenty of oil around. What are you talking about?
Right. And you know what? That whole business about the CFTC and the reforms, that's actually a great little story, and it's really all can be owed to Bernie Sanders, who this was a brokered deal when Obama nominated Gary Gensler to be the head of the CFTC. Gensler, of course, is a former Goldman Sachs banker, a former aide to Bob Rubin, who was kind of notorious in that community for having deregulated, pushed for the deregulation of derivatives. Sanders placed a hold on his nomination, and subsequently they kind of brokered a compromise that said that Sanders would lift that hold in exchange for a promise that there would be real reform in the area of the commodities market. So now that that is going through, it's all good news so far. It looks like it's going to go through, but that's because there was a little bit of opposition to Gensler's nomination.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talked to Greenberger about that a few times, and it's been quite amazing that we've seen such a run-up again. I mean, just even, you know, last month or so, I mean, just an amazing run-up. Well, I appreciate your help here and clearing up a few things. We'll make sure to disseminate a link to the Rolling Stone article. And, Matt, I appreciate you spending the time and putting this together and kind of enlightening all of us about what's going on in the financial world. And, you know, hopefully we'll see some of you in the future.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Have a good day.
Take care, Matt.
Bye-bye. Well, that in the business we call a wrap. That was kind of an interesting show, I think. Mac Taibbi, listen, you have to remember something. Stick around for next week. We're going to have somebody that I think you know pretty well. His name is Jim Rogers. He's the investment biker, and he's a guy that lives in Singapore. He's very, very knowledgeable on Asian, very down, I think, on the U.S. But we'll talk to him. I think he has some interesting things to talk about. He's made just a great, great level of predictions. He's a guy that wears a bow tie, shows up on CNBC, Bloomberg, all the various channels quite often. But I am so interested in talking to him. I have to actually record this at about 9:30 p.m. next week. In the morning for Singapore time for him. But we did get to line that up. We're trying to also get Meredith Whitney. We're trying to see if we can pick her brain and why she did, in fact, do that upgrade right before. And we have calls in to a lot of interesting people. Also, we have lined up coming up in the next couple of months some just amazing guests. So stick around. Please make sure that you stay with us here at The Disciplined Investor. And, of course, tell a friend. You also, I think I mentioned this before. Check out the Winning Investor Podcast, called the Winning Investor Podcast. If you want to know about PE ratios, PEG ratios, basic technical analysis, things of that nature, that's the place to check it out. It's part of the Quick and Dirty Tips. That's something that I'm doing in contemplation of or in desire to teach you a little bit more about the basics here. So check that out, called the Winning Investor Podcast. And make sure that if you haven't done so, check out that virtual tour. We'll make sure to get that link right now. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And check it out. And I think I have a couple more surprises for you next week that I think you'll be really interested in. And I'll bring you a couple more positions that we like. And make sure to go to the website, because we always have updates there as well. This is Andrew Horowitz for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Have a great week, a prosperous week, and be careful out there. It's a crazy market. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.